On a Monday, it is a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Governor Evers vetoed a series of Republican-backed bills last week that would have changed our election laws and put new restrictions on absentee voting. Other voting-related proposals are in the works regarding voter pre-registration and education. That's where we start with Democratic Representative Lee Snodgrass. Do you have a 16 or 17-year-old? Are they ready to vote? Did your civics class do an adequate job of teaching you about voting? It's 800-642-1234. Representative Snodgrass's Assembly District includes Menasha and Central Appleton. Representative Snodgrass, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me this morning.
So this legislation you've introduced regarding voter education and pre-registration for 16-year-olds and 17-year-olds, why do you think it's important for voter education to begin at a younger age?
Well, actually, this is a bill that came to us from the best way possible, from young people who were disappointed in the lack of information that they had about voting. Two young Oshkosh high school students approached myself and Gordon Hins and Christina Shelton. And we had a really great discussion about why young people aren't voting and how we can encourage them to get involved in the process. So this really came from the young voters themselves and young future voters themselves.
So a grassroots idea, born from that into legislation. When should young people begin to be educated on civic responsibility and voting?
Well, actually, one of the bills would require that voter education start already in kindergarten. It would encourage teachers to have at least 1 hour of civics education, of voter-specific education, obviously appropriate to the age, so that from the very beginning, students are getting used to the fact that voting is just a regular process. It's something that we should all participate in and make sure that it's demystified from an early age.
So how does this bill reinforce or add to the pre-existing curriculum in schools about civics?
The young women did great research on this, and they worked with educators and they worked with local school districts, and it would require, again, just sort of voter-specific information. So at kindergarten, it might just be a fact about, what does representation mean, and, maybe an exercise in that classroom. And as you get older, it's an understanding of how do you register to vote, what is important, what might be on your ballot, all those types of things that unfortunately now we don't always learn at home. And so learning them in school is a great way to make sure we're not missing any of those gaps and we're getting people who are eligible to vote excited about voting even before they're able to legally vote.
And so you're also looking at least 1 hour of voter education instruction in each elementary and high school grade. So really embedding it throughout the education years.
Yeah, I think most of us who are regular voters realize that it's something that we did as children with our parents. We heard our parents talking about voting. Many of us were brought into the voting booth. That doesn't always happen anymore. And as we know, voting is more important than ever. When people say to me, well, I'm not political, I say, well, do you have recycling pickup? And do you have roads that you like to drive on? Essentially, all of these things come down to who you vote for at a local level, a state level, and a federal level. So making sure people understand just how much their voice matters in their everyday life for voting, I think, is really essential.
And explain the legislation about voter pre-registration for 16 and 17-year-olds. What does that look like?
Well, that's really interesting, too, because, sometimes when people turn 18, obviously there's a lot going on at that stage of your life. You're usually trying to figure out what you're going to do after high school. You're quite busy. And sometimes voting and registering to vote is not the priority. So this would allow our early registration to vote so that you're, ready to go as soon as that's the case. And then one of the bills that Representative Shelton was lead author on actually would require a constitutional amendment, but it would allow 17-year-olds to vote in a primary if they are going to be eligible to vote in that general election. So there's a distinction there for that bill.
We're talking with Lee Snodgrass, a Democratic representative for the 57th Assembly District, includes Menasha and Central Appleton, as we discuss legislation she has had a hand in. You can join in. Do you live in the area? What questions do you have for your representative? Do you have a teenager as they prepare to start voting? How have you prepared them to exercise their Democratic right? 800-642-1234. I want to move on to another piece of legislation you co-authored that would establish a task force to study the legal and societal barriers to equality for transgender, intersex, non-binary, and gender non-conforming people. What areas are you looking at in society that lawmakers are interested in studying?
Well, right now, you know, the Transgender Equality Task Force is really designed so that we can study what these barriers are, so that we can understand what future legislation might be good to introduce so that we can really establish full equality. Right now, there's a lot of discrimination in healthcare, in housing, in the workforce, and we want to make sure that everybody in Wisconsin, no matter how they identify, no matter their gender, has an equal footing and has equal rights in the law. And right now, that just simply is not the case in all situations.
So, you know, this is a really large area. It could be healthcare, it could be education, housing. I mean, the list is employment. The list is so large. How do you tackle this?
Well, you know, I think sometimes people hear the word task force and they kind of roll their eyes and they think, you know, this is a waste of time. But truly, legislators oftentimes, you know, we all come from varying backgrounds. You know, most of us were not politicians from the get-go. We weren't lawmakers from the get-go. So the best way to understand, I think, some of these barriers and some of the information that we simply don't have is to make sure that we bring the experts to the table, make sure that we bring the people to the table who have been working and supporting the transgender community for a while. Might be health experts, might be physicians, it might be somebody in housing, it might be organizations that are already doing that work. And so having all those voices to the table provides us really with a fact-finding situation so that we can truly understand some of the obstacles that people are facing, and we can provide some legislative solutions.
What is the timeline for this committee to convene, to work together?
It was circulating for co-sponsorship in June. As you know, we have a divided house in Madison right now. So we're kind of at the mercy of when these bills are assigned committees, and mm-hmm. if they get into committee and get a hearing, and then if we're fortunate enough for that to happen, to getting it to the floor. So obviously we'd like to see this happen sooner rather than later. You know, we're going to be bumping up against, you know, of course, campaign season for everybody. So I'd like to see this established now. Again, it's not about putting out bills. It's really just about finding information and researching so that we can make sure that Wisconsin is a place that's welcoming and equal for everyone.
Yeah. So why wait to create a task force through legislation rather than just digging in and starting to work on legislation outright?
Well, you know, we didn't introduce the equality agenda in the 2021 equality agenda, which did include a huge package of bills. Transgender Visibility Day was one of them. Transgender Day of Remembrance. There was the Marriage and Family Equality Act, which was also circulated, which you know, makes references in the statutes to gender neutral terms rather than, you know, man and wife. We had the Gender Identity and Gender Expression Non-Discrimination Bill. Trying to eliminate the constitutional restrictions that Wisconsin has on marriage that's still in the books, and then making sure that one of the ones that I was the author on was to eliminate conversion therapy for minors in the state of Wisconsin. So we're doing work now. We've already dug in, and all of those bills were also ones that we drew with the support of the LGBTQ+ community. We had a listening session even before we were all sworn in to make sure that we were doing what people wanted to see from us in terms of LGBTQ+ equality.
We're talking with Democratic State Representative Lee Snodgrass of Appleton. Are you a member of the LGBTQ community? What barriers to equality do you face in Wisconsin? And how should lawmakers address inclusion? What issues do you think lawmakers should be focusing on in these times? Join in 800-642-1234. There's more State Cap in a minute here on the Ideas Network. you have aligned to first-term Democratic State Representative Lee Snodgrass on the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Do you live in Menasha or in Appleton? What questions do you have for your representative about pandemic protocols? The CDC's COVID tracker says transmission is high in about 80% of Wisconsin. Are you a struggling business in the Fox Valley? What has the pandemic brought? How would you rate the economic recovery in the Fox Cities? 800-642-1234. Representative Lee Snodgrass is with us for about 10 more minutes. Focusing in now on the pandemic, Winnebago County had almost 19,000 confirmed cases. Outagamie County, as of this morning, over 21,000. How is the state working with local health officials to help reduce the spread of COVID in your district?
Yeah, you know, I'm somebody who believes when it comes to something as serious as a global public health crisis, that the state government does have a responsibility to step in. Unfortunately, those attempts were overturned in the courts. So we're dealing with really a patchwork situation here. I think at this point, the best thing that state lawmakers can do is to encourage people to get their vaccination. We know that that is absolutely the best way to prevent hospitalization and death, to encourage people to respect local businesses, local ordinances that require mask wearing. We also know that that's still, in fact, with the Delta variant, incredibly important. So I think all of these things are things that we have a responsibility to do and encourage. But as you noted, right now it's sort of county by county and municipality by municipality.
I hear you say the word encourage. How do you feel about COVID vaccine requirements to stay on the job or to stay in school?
You know, it's difficult because, like I said, I do think when it comes to something like a global health crisis, the state does have a responsibility, and we know that that would discourage, hospitalization and death. At this point, I think that we're in a situation where we need to try and work with individual businesses, organizations, and school districts. I'm strongly encouraging the school districts in my area, which have opted for optional masking, to consider mandating masking, especially for those vulnerable children who are unable to be vaccinated under the age of 12. So I do think that there are cases where mandatory vaccination makes a lot of sense. One of those, I believe, is in the health community. I think if you're going to be serving people front lines as a healthcare worker, of course you want to be protecting yourself, but you also want to make sure that you're not carrying carrying the virus as a asymptomatic carrier. So I do think it's really important in the healthcare community and certain businesses where people are going to be sort of put all together. You know, maybe it's in an airline and things like that, where mandates might make more sense.
And it sounds like you feel that it's okay for, you know, educational systems or businesses to institute mask requirements or wear masks regardless of your vaccination status?
Based on the data from the CDC and the American Academy of Pediatrics and the medical experts, of which very few of our lawmakers are actually medical experts, I do believe that it's important that we protect our youngest, most vulnerable. And that, to me, means requiring vaccinations or mask wearing if you're going to be in those situations.
Let's discuss jumpstarting the Appleton economy for a bit. What are the challenges you're seeing as you look at the economy in your district?
You know, that's actually, I think mask wearing and vaccinations is actually a really big key to economic recovery. I tweeted a while back that getting the vaccine is one of the best things you can do to support businesses because, you know, I look at a business like in my community, the Fox Cities Performing Arts Center, and they want to be able to have, you know, people in seats. They want to have ticket holders again in their concert halls. And with, people traveling from all over, traveling troops, you know, the stage crew, all those things, they want to make sure that the people coming into their environment are vaccinated and aren't going to be inadvertently spreading the COVID-19 virus. So I think that's a really important component. I also think, you know, we can be respectful of businesses who say, hey, I'm requiring a mask when you enter here, to keep making sure that we're shopping at those businesses. And then, of course, we're working through the labor shortage. You know, there is a labor shortage and has been for a while, and that's impacting the Fox Cities as well.
Yeah, I want to pick up there on labor shortages. What would you say to businesses that just can't get people to work or to get fill their jobs. What are you doing about that? What are you saying?
I'm having a lot of conversations about that, actually. I was talking to the public works director in Appleton about the federal infrastructure bill and said, you must be really excited. And her comment was, I'm very excited, but we don't have contractors that can bid on the work we have now because they don't have enough people. So I look at what the barriers are. My next question is, what do you think is the barrier to getting people to work? And every single person that I've asked, whether it be in public sector or private sector, has said the childcare crisis, making sure that we have access to childcare that's affordable and at all hours and all shifts, and transportation, making sure that we have ways that people can get to and from work if they don't own a car. So these are two huge things that we can be working on.
We're talking with Lee Snodgrass, a Democratic representative for the 57th District of the Assembly, includes Menasha and Central Appleton, as we discuss legislation and political issues before her. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you live in the Fox Cities? What questions do you have for your representative? 800-642-1234. Shifting the focus here to pollinators, you and State Senator Melissa Agard introduced a package of bills to protect pollinators. What exactly would this legislation do?
Yeah, I'm really excited about this. This really was inspired by Appleton starting No Mow May a while back, which in our local municipality gave people a pass the month of May from mowing their lawns so that we can encourage more pollinators to be a part of our ecosystem. We know that there is a pollinators are reducing, and we know what that does to our food supply. So this package of bills that I introduced with Senator Agard is really a pollinator protection package. These are bills that would prevent harm from existing pollinator habitats and pollinators themselves.
Okay, and specifically, you know, what species are most at risk, and how would they be protected?
Well, most pollinators are it's birds, it's bees, it's butterflies. So this would impact all of them, primarily, however, bees. You know, the rusty patch bumblebee is a bee that has been added to the endangered species list, actually. And some good news in Appleton is we actually, after No Mow May, spotted a rusty patch bumblebee in somebody's yard. So we do know that this works. One of the bills would allow for local regulation of pesticides to protect pollinators. Right now, everybody's sort of familiar with the ban on bans that does prevent municipalities from making some decisions that are, for instance, banning plastic bags, single-use plastic bags. This would add a ninth exception to the existing state statute, which would allow them to ban certain pesticides that were harmful to pollinators. The other bill would ask the DNR to, within a one-mile radius of any pollinator habitat on protected land maintained by the DNR, they would not be able to use neonicotinoids, which is a particularly harmful pesticide for pollinators. And the other one is really what I would call a truth in labeling bill. And this says that if you're going to be selling plants or seeds that are, quote, friendly to pollinators or pollinator friendly, you have to make sure that they have not been treated with pesticides and insecticides that are harmful to pollinators themselves.
Have you gotten bipartisan support? What have your colleagues said about this package?
Actually, in this divided government, we have gotten some bipartisan support. Two of the other freshman legislators on the other side of the aisle have signed on to a couple of them, so I'm very hopeful. And actually, the conversations that I've been having with people are with Democrats and Republicans alike, who have all realized, you know what, we're going to have to do something. I don't see those birds and butterflies those bees and butterflies like I used to. And so that connection to our food source, knowing how important food production is to Wisconsin's economy, is really something that everybody feels is something that we should all be invested in. So I'm hopeful.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about you as you assumed office at the beginning of the year. What are your biggest priorities as a freshman lawmaker?
It's been a whirlwind. It's been, you know, we were sworn in virtually. This is, you know, politics is definitely a relationship building career. And so it's been difficult for all of us to sort of make those connections that we need to. But the things that I'm working on, I was committed to the pollinator legislation. I'm really excited to be on the Forestry, Parks, and Outdoor Recreation Committee. I'm a big multimodal transportation person, been working on ways that we can increase our connectivity by bikes, and we can make really the Fox Valley the next destination spot in terms of bike trails and walking trails. And I'm also really excited about some of the bills that we have coming up on voter education, as we said. One of the bills that Representative Shelton and I introduced also was a bill that would require state legislators like myself to participate in the process by working as poll workers when we're not on the ballot. So those have been my priorities so far.
Well, Representative Snodgrass, thank you for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Lee Snodgrass is a Democratic representative for the 57th District of the State Assembly, includes Menasha and Central Appleton. Coming up, we talk with the DOT Secretary Designee about what President Biden's infrastructure bill means specifically for Wisconsin. How do you feel about the state of Wisconsin's roads and bridges? It's 800-642-1234 to join in. There's more State Cap after this news update on the Ideas Network. Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to the latest Marquette University Law School poll out last week, 53% of Wisconsin voters support President Biden's infrastructure plan, which the White House says could invest $5.2 billion for federal aid highway repair programs in Wisconsin and $225 million for bridge repair and replacement over 5 years. What do you want to know about the state's highway construction plans and what the federal aid would mean? What fixes are most important to you? 800-642-1234. Craig Thompson is Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Transportation. Secretary Thompson, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. Starting with infrastructure, what would the $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill mean for Wisconsin?
Well, it would mean a lot of things because the infrastructure bill really is pretty comprehensive. It would help us in our areas for our state highways and interstates. It would help us be able to get more money to locals for our local roads. It would help us public infrastructure, freight and passenger rail. And so it really would help us in a lot of ways. And in addition to the increased resources and funding, what really would be nice as well is that we would know for the next 5 years what our funding is going to be. So that certainty really helps us to build a plan and be more efficient with the dollars we are going to get.
So how would these federal dollars parlay with state budget dollars?
Well, I think it really sets up pretty well. The last two budgets, we really focused, two budgets ago was the first time in really a generation here in Wisconsin that we raised some new revenue to go into transportation, and it was sorely needed. So in that budget and then in the most recent budget, we've really directed and come to a lot of consensus actually with the legislature on this in two main areas. And it's really one overall arching area, which is fixing what we currently have. So the increased funding has either gone into what's known as the State Highway Rehabilitation Program, which means just improving the conditions of our current two-lane state highways, or it's gone to local governments in the form of general transportation aids or local road improvement program. That's really where all the uppers have gone.
So when you look across the state, which transportation projects could really use this federal funding as you have this consistency over the next 5 years?
Well, again, a lot of it is going to go into trying to just improve our conditions, helping out our locals with all the road miles they have to maintain, us getting our conditions. We finally stopped the decline of the condition on our state highways, and it's plateaued and is beginning to improve. This will help us accelerate that. But, of course, there are some more major programs out there that towards the latter end of those 5 years that we could have probably accelerated. There's money in this federal package for what's known as bridges of economic significance. And we know right now that what's known as the Blatnik Bridge up in the Duluth Superior area is one of those that we're going to be doing jointly with Minnesota, which is very important and will be expensive. So we're hoping we can get that moved up into there. We've got Wisconsin River bridges by the Wisconsin Dells. And so we've got a lot of different projects that we can look at that this federal money is going to help us with quite a bit.
When I hear you say that we've plateaued and turned a corner for the positive on the conditions of our infrastructure and our roads and bridges, how do you determine that?
So we have these pavement vans that go out and measure the conditions of our roads they do about half of all the lane miles each year and switch off into the others. And so then they report that back. There's what's known as the International Roughness Index, which every state DOT is required to submit to the Federal Highway Administration. And then we have a little bit more in-depth way of looking at our pavement conditions here to give us a better idea of how to prioritize our lane miles. So we know every 2 years, basically, the percent that's in good, fair, in poor condition. And we had been sliding for a long time, and so we stemmed that. We're starting to see some improvement. And I think in the next couple of years, we'll see that continue to tick up.
So going back to the infrastructure bill, and the House will be back in session a week from today to consider legislation, the White House says Wisconsin could receive $592 million for public transportation projects. What kind of projects should get the priority?
Well, we have so many different types of public transportation. Obviously, in our bigger cities in Madison and Milwaukee, and even La Crosse, Green Bay, some of those size cities, we think of the bus systems. But there's a lot of transit that's needed out in the more rural areas, too. And I think this increased dollars, if this bill would pass, would help us really across all of those. And this is one area that, unfortunately, we haven't come to consensus with the legislature on. We have tried to increase funding for mass transit in both of the last two budgets, as well as some funding for bus capital replacement. And that has been taken out or significantly reduced in each of these last two budgets. And as a matter of fact, in this most recent one, funding for Milwaukee and Madison for 1 year was actually slashed because they believe because of the federal money they got, the legislature decided to reduce their funding. So this direct federal money for public transit, I think, will help both our larger cities and some of our paratransit and other transit programs in our more rural areas of the state.
Well, as you mentioned, the budget cuts state transportation system funding to Madison and Milwaukee in half. That's a roughly $41 million drop in funding. How will that be felt by people who live and rely on public transportation in Wisconsin's two largest cities?
Well, what's been frustrating about the debate over transit in Wisconsin, and it's really in a lot of the other states in the country, it's not as much of a red or blue issue. But the problem is the more you invest in transit, the more reliable you can make it, the more accessible you can make it. You know, for example, if you're on the east side of Milwaukee and you're taking the bus to get to a job out on the western side or to Waukesha, and you've got to transfer three times and it takes you an hour and a half, that really is a significant disincentive to use public transit. So the more we can invest in it, Milwaukee County is now going to be doing a bus rapid transit system, which I think is going to be just very well received by people there. The more you can guarantee on time, the more you have accessible stops, then transit usage goes up. And the more you disinvest in it, the opposite happens. And then some point in, say, transit ridership is down or there isn't as much. But a lot of that has to do with the fact that we're not providing the product necessarily that we need to. And it's not because the locals aren't doing a good job. It's just that the resources there. So I think this federal dollars, the more resources we get there, we're going to be able to greatly increase the frequencies and the accessibility and the reliability. And I think it will really show, the numbers will show that people want to use public transit and do use public transit. As a matter of fact, we formed a non-driver advisory committee at the DOT, and it's, there's 1.2 million people in the state that are non-drivers. So we really have to take that into account more as we plan our transportation system.
1.2 million Wisconsinites non-drivers. You know, I want to just circle back to one thing you said there about transportation. And we spoke with Representative Lee Snodgrass just a moment ago, and transportation is an issue for addressing labor shortages in the Fox Cities. What are lawmakers telling you about transportation needs around their districts, around the state?
Well, that's the thing, is when we break it down into specific districts, we do hear a lot of legislators tell us that they do want to see some of these other forms of transportation funded, and it is a labor issue. There's the greatest impediment to a job is not being able to get there or not being able to get there reliably. So there's a direct connection there. We know that, especially in the larger cities, a large percent of the people that use transit is to get to and from jobs. So, we're hoping we can continue to work with area businesses and others to really just press that point home to legislators that this is an economic development question as well.
We're talking with Craig Thompson, who is Secretary Designee of the State Department of Transportation, as we look at state transportation issues as related to the spending plan as well as the infrastructure bill being debated in the federal government. You can join in. What questions do you have for the Secretary? What do you think of the DOT and its priorities? What do you want to know about the state's highway construction goals, plans? 800-642-1234. Going back to the rural areas, what do you hope the state budget can do for public transportation in these rural communities that don't have a base, a network of public transportation?
So in those communities, a lot of times it's shared ride taxis. It's the areas, agencies, and aging and disabilities that provide a lot of different, more nimble forms of transit. And so I think by getting them more funding, we can provide a lot more resources to be able to get to people in real rural areas where it may not be served by, you know, a bus per se. And, you know, this is really important to people outstate, being able to stay in their homes, especially as they age or they have different disabilities. So I think this infrastructure bill, again, if it passes, will allow us to work with really predominantly our counties are the providers for that across the state. And they do a wonderful job. But I think if we get them more resources, we should be able to reach more people and make sure that they're able to stay in their homes.
So looking now at the I-94 expansion, the state budget authorizes starting up the expansion project in Milwaukee County. What is the status?
So we have moved to what is called a supplemental environmental impact statement.
Uh-huh.
So over the course of the next, close to a year, we're going to continue. We're going to look at updated traffic patterns and numbers. I'd like to say post-pandemic. Hopefully we're getting to post-pandemic. But the most recent traffic numbers, looking at some of the assumptions, looking at the six-lane versus the eight-lane configuration, and really going out and having more public input from residents and others that have an interest in this. But we're looking at hopefully by the end of 2022 to have what's known as a record of decision or the go-ahead from the federal government to move forward, and whatever ultimately comes out of that whole process is the preferred alternative to reconstruct that very important 3.5-mile stretch of I-94 in front of American Family Field and State Fair and all those areas there.
Well, there is opposition to the expansion and it being seen as helping suburban commuters more than people who live near the freeway and rely on public transportation. What is your response?
So what everybody agrees on, I think, is that it needs to be rebuilt. It's 60-plus years old. Each end of it, the Marquette Interchange has been rebuilt and the Zoo Interchange has been rebuilt. But where there has been some disagreement over, and we're going to have further conversation, like I said, during the supplemental environmental impact statement, is whether you rebuild that with six lanes or whether you make it match what's on each end, which is eight lanes. The concern has been if you build, you know, this should last the next 70 years or so, and most people wouldn't engineer a stretch of interstate to be shaped like an hourglass, where you've got constricted in the middle. So you'd have merging, dropping lanes coming in each direction. And that's the concern. That stretch right now is 2.5 times as dangerous as other roads of its type in the state. So we need to look at that, if there's ways to mitigate that. If not, but that 3.5-mile stretch is very important to keep the traveling folks. And as a matter of fact, most of the studies, traffic studies we've done, the majority of people using it do actually live in that area. But there's also, it's very important for goods and freight to move through there as well. And we're also looking for, as part of this project, to the mitigation. We're working closely with Milwaukee County, the county executive, and their transit director to be able to get some mitigation dollars to go directly to them to help significantly increase transit as a result, too, and increase some of the frequency of some of the lines there as well. So
let's pause right there with Transportation Secretary Designee Craig Thompson as we look at infrastructure priorities underway, planned for the future. Your thoughts and questions, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute for more State Cap on the Ideas Network. It's a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to the 511 construction projects map, 103 construction projects are currently underway throughout Wisconsin. Hundreds were completed last year amid the pandemic. How are roads where you are? Milwaukee area, how do you feel about transportation priorities and the I-94 expansion? What updates do you want on construction? 800-642-1234. Transportation Secretary Designee Craig Thompson with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's go to Marcus now in Milwaukee. Hi, Marcus.
Good morning. So I have two questions for you, sir. Number one, when they just redid the zoo interchange, as you head northbound up 45, you have traffic merging from both the left and the right side. And I thought part of the point of redoing it was no longer to have traffic merging in from the left lane. My second question is since we've received all this money from the federal government, why don't we take a look at possibly, since we're at the same latitude as Germany, doing something like what they've done with the Autobahn, where instead of pouring, 3 to 4 inches of asphalt with substrate underneath, pouring 5 to 6 inches of concrete with some rebar or chicken mesh in there, and then we'll end up getting 20 to 30 years before we need repairs as opposed to with asphalt every 3 to 5.
Marcus, thanks. Secretary.
So on the first part, on the north leg of the zoo there with the merging, I believe I've made a note, Marcus, but we shouldn't be long-term once we're done. I think you're correct about not wanting to have that merging from the left. But I have made a note to check with our folks to see where that is at. So I will check, and then I appreciate you bringing that up. As far as engineering it with thicker concrete, like Germany, first of all, the way we're doing it right now, it should last up to about 70 years, and it should only need to be resurfaced or redone about every 15 years. It shouldn't be every 3 to 5. So, it's always a cost-benefit ratio about, how thick to go, for how much upfront cost. We feel right now where we're at with how they're being engineered and built that every 15 years with some resurfacing that they should be able to last the way we're engineering and building, and we should be able to get about 70 years of life out of them. The way they were done in the 50s and 60s, they expected to get 50 to 60 years out of life out of them, and that's pretty much what we've gotten so far.
Do you feel that the technology has improved or changed? I mean, as you look at climate change, as you look at the impact that these roads have to meet with flooding, with all of the different weather events?
So, yeah, technology has definitely improved, and there's a lot of folks in the industry. There's, what we call cold-in-place recycling. There's just a lot of materials. The specifications have changed on a lot of the inputs that go into there. As far as climate change, that obviously is something we're looking at very significantly, in terms of resiliency, that we build back in areas if we think there's going to be persistent weather events that we don't, maybe a bridge needs to be higher, maybe a road needs to be, culverts need to be changed, different things like that. And then really longer term, as we know, the combustible engine is a great contributor. This budget at infrastructure level is going to have about $79 million for electric vehicle charging apparatuses for us in Wisconsin. We've invested more at the state level. I think we're going to be moving much more rapidly to electrification of our transportation system than people realize. It's coming quick, and I think it'll be very good for the environment.
Where are you looking at clustering charging stations?
That's a great question, Kate, and we've got groups looking at that.
Mm-hmm.
What's known as range hesitancy, we want to make sure that people don't feel that they're going to get the parts where they run out and can't be close enough to get a charge. So we've got folks looking at the map. We're obviously going to be wanting to partner with the private sector as well, and I think there's a lot of those folks that are going to maybe step in and have some at their place, but we have to make sure from the public sector side that we've got the grid covered where there's not big gaps.
Going back to the budget and borrowing, there's $223.5 million in borrowing over the two-year budget for road and infrastructure projects. Governor Evers, as you know, had pushed for a whole lot more. What do you think of the borrowing level for the state budget to accomplish the necessary projects?
Well, when we submitted our budget, that was prior to any of the additional federal money that came into Wisconsin or the reestimate that the Fiscal Bureau did of additional $4 billion. So our only method at that time, when we were still in the throes of the pandemic, was to try to ticks binding back up some, even though we had reduced at the historic lows. So when the legislature ended up reducing that, I think at the point in time they stood at it, made sense. And I think that's why the governor left it there and signed it. And we're really at the lowest level of bonding in Wisconsin that we've been at in many, many years. And it really positions us pretty well.
We're talking with Craig Thompson, Secretary Designee of the Department of Transportation, as we look at transportation funding and projects within the state. Taking your questions, 800-642-1234. Let's move to rail. About 650 miles of railroad tracks in our state in Upper Michigan were sold in March. What does this mean for Wisconsin?
Yeah, so for a lot of northeastern Wisconsin, Green Bay and up, this is very significant. A lot of our hardwood industry, a lot of our bulk freight, the most efficient way for them to move that is by rail. That had been served by Canadian National. And like you said, Kate, they had sold a lot of the lines that they had had. Watco is in the process of purchasing that. That still has to be approved by the Surface Transportation Board, that acquisition, the federal level, so we're waiting to hear on that. And we want to make sure that, you know, the shippers in that part of the area want to make sure that the service model that's provided then, you know, takes their needs into account. And I'm hopeful that it will.
So what do you see in terms of having reliable rail access to help our economy through this pandemic? What is the state of rail in Wisconsin?
Well, we have four Class One railroads that go through Wisconsin that serve, you know, that run through and serve a lot of the areas in here. And then we've got some short lines and some different lines like Watco that serve just Wisconsin. And so for a lot of our areas, it's very important. I think we're doing well. We've got a freight rail improvement program that we upgrade stretches that have been abandoned, which we've been doing. So I think freight rail is doing pretty well, and we're pretty excited on the passenger rail side, too. We just Minnesota legislature passed their side of the agreement, and we're poised to move forward on what's known as the TCMC, or the Twin Cities to Milwaukee to Chicago line. That's going to begin running in a couple of years. That'll go back daily between Minneapolis and Chicago and stop in Wisconsin between, so we're excited about that as well.
With this infrastructure bill on the federal level, is there any focus on that passenger rail side? Would it have any impact there?
Yes, there is. The Biden administration is definitely pro-passenger rail. There is some significant funds in there for that. And so, you know, I just talked about that Twin Cities to Chicago line. Our Hiawatha line between Chicago or between Milwaukee and Chicago has been one of the successful Amtrak lines in the country. So we've got a lot of areas we could put it into increased ridership.
Well, Secretary Thompson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Craig Thompson is Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Transportation. Just ahead, we explore the concept of critical race theory. An educational scholar reflects on racial bias in textbooks and what needs to change in the classroom to better educate children about the history of racism in the U.S. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.